From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A conversation with Vandana Shiva on biopiracy, the plunder of nature and knowledge.
What you have is the centers of the global economy, the powerful of the global economy, literally pirating through patents what keeps life and sustenance possible for the two-thirds poorer majority of this world. I've called it the second coming of Columbus.
Also, a look at the Supreme Court decision on fusion. That's the Supreme Court decision that's a major blow to third parties. We'll look at the new party. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democrats threatened again to block action on a GOP bill as talks between the White House and a key Senate Republican failed to break the impasse delaying Alexis Herman's nomination to be Labor Secretary. For the second day in a row, Republicans scheduled a vote to cut off debate on a bill to limit lawsuits filed against volunteers to charities, only to have the effort stymied by Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy. Kennedy has threatened to filibuster all but essential legislative business until Herman has her day in the Senate. One of President Clinton's chief critics on Capitol Hill says the Whitewater prosecutor's investigation has dragged on too long, this according to news reports. The American public has just grown sick and tired of it, says Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato outside the Senate chamber in Washington. D'Amato's remarks also were carried in New York's Daily News. D'Amato led the Senate's two-year Whitewater investigation. He also criticized prosecutor Kenneth Starr's handling of the criminal investigation into Whitewater, a complex affair that includes allegations from fraudulent land deals to a possible cover-up. It's also important to point out that Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato will be running for re-election. Defiant members of a group that claims Texas was illegally annexed by the United States warn police to back away from their trailer, saying they will not be taken by force. The standoff began 4 days ago in the remote Davis Mountains, 170 miles southeast of El Paso, after members of the Republic of Texas took two neighbors hostage in retaliation for the arrests of two followers. Also in Texas, an inmate was executed by injection for killing a couple who had tried to help him get his life back in order after he was paroled. Ernest Orville Boldry died minutes after the lethal dose of drugs began flowing into his veins. Initial reviews are mixed for a proposal to narrow the disparity in federal drug sentencing laws that treat crack cocaine trafficking more harshly than selling powder cocaine. Under current law, the same five-year mandatory sentence is triggered by trafficking offenses involving at least 500 grams of powder cocaine or 5 grams of crack. The U.S. Sentencing Commission proposed narrowing that gap yesterday by reducing the threshold for powder and raising it for crack. After a landmark verdict against a former Army drill sergeant charged with raping his trainees, women's advocates called for a review of how the military responds to sexual harassment claims. Staff Sergeant Delmar Simpson was convicted yesterday of raping 6 female trainees, a total of 18 times in the most serious case yet to come out of the sex scandal that has shaken the Army and prompted investigations at installations worldwide. He could be sentenced to life in prison after a sentencing hearing next Monday. Critics say the Aberdeen training ground case is a brutal, frightening example of why things need to be changed. And this news from Zaire, rebels today shrugged off President Mobutu Sese Seko's refusal to hold talks and said they would take their war to the capital of Kinshasa. A senior aide to rebel chief Laurent Kabila told Reuters the rebels had nothing to lose from Mobutu's refusal to meet Kabila on a South African Navy ship. The aide said rebels were consolidating a push towards the capital from Kikwit. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today on the show, we're going to take an extended look at biopiracy, or the theft of the world's biological wealth by major corporations. Just a few days ago, I had a chance to speak with internationally renowned ecologist, activist, and physicist Vandana Shiva. She's the director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy. based in India, and she's just published a new book called Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge. Vedana Shiva, why don't we start with the main idea of your new book, what you're calling Piracy Through Patents, The Second Coming of Columbus.
Interestingly, today's Wall Street Journal's first column talks about piracy of CDs and discs by China. Very rarely does the West talk about the piracy the West is engaged in. And this is the piracy of both the biodiversity, the richness of living resources in tropical countries and the third world, as well as the knowledge associated with them. It so happens that it's the poorest part of the world that have survived with biodiversity because they were left in the fringes, they were in the margins. And it's also the poorest people, particularly women, who have kept biodiversity knowledge alive. And so what you have is the centers of the global economy, the powerful of the global economy, literally pirating through patents what keeps life and sustenance possible for the two-thirds poorer majority of this world. I've called it the second coming of Columbus because, in a way, the language is so similar. Columbus also sailed out with a piece of paper. They were used to be called letters patents in those days, too. And these were authorization given by the merchant adventurers 500 years ago, given by the princes and the queens of Europe, justified by the papal bull of 1493 to say, go out and take over the lands and territories of the heathens and destroy whatever they have and own it on our behalf. If land was emptied 500 years ago, 500 years later, what is being emptied is life itself, the life of biodiversity, life within biodiversity, within organisms, microorganisms, plants, animals, as well as the knowledge and the rights that go with it.
Can you explain what you mean by biodiversity, Dr. Shiva?
Well, biodiversity is basically just simply biological diversity, the diversity of the life forms on this planet. And I come from a society where we've always seen diverse life forms as a continuity of the Earth family. We've never separated ourselves in any hierarchy between human society, for which the rest of life is just to be exploited, just an object. For us, our trees and our plants and our microorganisms are our brothers and sisters. They're part of our family. That is the biodiversity, and it includes us. It includes human beings. It includes the diversity of human races, which are now also being pirated. It's not just that the neem tree, which we have used for centuries for healing and pest control, has been pirated and patented. The neem has been pirated, but the haldi, which every grandmother uses every day to heal the wounds when we fall and bruise our knees, the first thing the grandmother will do is put haldi paste on it. Now the Mississippi Medical Center claims to have invented the use of haldi in neem healing. But humans, too, are being pirated. The Guami Indian cell line, the Hagahai cell line. But to me, one of the most outrageous patents has been the one on the the blood from the umbilical cord, which has tremendous healing power, a healing capacity. That has been patented. And of course, there's a tremendous outcry. Even the medical profession in Europe is standing up against a company called BioSite, a U.S. company. And the United States is the leader in biopiracy.
Can you explain who is doing this patenting of both the cell lines of the Hagahai people and of blood from an umbilical cord?
Well, in the case of the Hagahai, it was the United States Department of Commerce. And in the case of the umbilical blood, it is a company called BioSite. What's basically happening is that there is a new convergence. And I believe this is central to the issue of democracy now in our period, at the end of the second millennium, beginning of the third millennium, according to the Christian calendar. Democracy basically, in my view, means the flourishing of diversity on its own terms, on terms of every participant of diversity. The shifts that are taking place is governments are becoming handmaidens to corporate pirates. And the United States has new laws that were introduced in 1988. They are called the Special 301 Clauses in the Trade Act, which empower the trade representative of the United States to go out to other countries and say, unless you change your patent laws and your intellectual property rights according to what suits our corporations, we will retaliate through trade action against you. That's basically, in my view, a protection of pirates, given that much of what is being patented in the living domain, in the life sciences, is really based on either piracy of living material and biological resources or theft of indigenous knowledge. So you have, on the one hand, a convergence of basically, you know, governments acting on behalf of corporations, inverting the role of governments to act on behalf of citizens. The second convergence that's taking place is so-called research institutions, which were supposed to be about scientific exploration, like the National Cancer Institute, go out and collect knowledge, collect ethnobotanical knowledge, and then pass it on to corporations, which then go ahead and patent it. So you have a strange asymmetry between a pretense at neutral science and neutral expeditions and neutral collaboration, using the facility of neutrality to then hand over for commercialization. Huh. I've called this the enclosure of the biological and intellectual commons.
So you take the neem tree, for example. Explain who has taken a patent out on it, and how does that affect the people who use it now and the tree itself?
We are basically campaigning on the neem tree, not about what these patents do now. For us, it's an outrage that some knowledge that has evolved out of the collective innovative capacity of thousands of Indians over millennia should be treated as a new invention in the United States. The impact, of course, on the people of India will be through the future use of these patents as excluding devices. Patents have two qualities to them. The first is they are claims of inventiveness and novelty. And when they're based on piracy, that claim to novelty is, of course, ethically and morally outrageous to us. But they're also claims to exclude others from the use of that resource or that process or that innovation, which means that over time, as corporations like W.R. Grace, which now hold a majority of the neem patents, as they start to consolidate control over the market and distribution and the raw material supply, what will happen is what's already happening. The prices of neem start to shoot up for the Indians. Indians can't use it anymore for spraying on their fields to control pests. They can't use it anymore for their indigenous medicine. It's consolidated. The control over the raw material goes into the hands of Grace, which then controls the global market. And in a way, people of India lose three times over. They lose their knowledge and they lose the recognition of their innovation. They lose access to the resources they have protected, because the neem has been protected as a sacred species in India. And that is what is being capitalized on. And they lose the economic options of being able to sell through cooperatives and community-based enterprises of small-scale processing to the people in the world who might want to have more ecological pest control.
You know, I thought it was interesting, Dr. Vandana Shiva, in your book, Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, you write, the journal Ag Biotechnology News has called W.R. Grace's processing plant the world's first neem tree-based biopesticide facility. Yet you write, nearly every home and village in India, however, has biopesticide facilities.
That's, you know, it's the outrage of this to me was because as a child, my mother has used neem in the home. I have, as a mother, used neem for my son. In tribal areas, the smallest tribal home will be extracting neem oils in the home. The only difference is they do it on a tiny scale. The women in a village might do it with 2 earthen pots, 3 earthen pots. But just because it is small scale does not mean it is crude and primitive. And just because Grace can set up a plant that can process 20 tons a day doesn't mean that it is sophisticated. It is still simple piracy of a process that was known.
You also talk about the pharmaceutical giants Eli Lilly and Merck Pharmaceuticals, as well as InBio, the National Biodiversity Institute of Costa Rica. Can you tell us about these examples?
Well, the particular example through which Merck shot up to fame was with this contract it wrote with this institute called InBio in Costa Rica to have full prospecting rights to the Costa Rican forests for all its biodiversity. Now, interestingly, the word bioprospecting is supposed to sound as if it's based on equity. To me, the fact that you can even use the word bioprospecting as if life and living diversity was like oil deposits somewhere, which only get found when explorers go out, rather than get known through ethnobotanists, basically using the generosity of sharing of traditional indigenous communities who have never treated knowledge as property, who have never treated their resources as property, and who are only too happy to share the knowledge of, we use this herb for healing, we use this food in this way. That knowledge is then consolidated. Merck has paid $1 million to InBio, and it looks like it's gone to Costa Rica. It's basically gone to InBio to set up the facilities for screening for Merck. So it's like a subsidy Merck has given to itself. It's not really gone to the benefits of Costa Rica. And basically then this investment is used to funnel out the resources and totally funnel out the knowledge from the Costa Rican people.
Now, explain exactly what you mean by bioprospecting. We had Victoria Tauli Corpus on a couple weeks ago from the Philippines, and she began to explain this. We had many people call in fascinated and furious about what they were hearing.
Well, bioprospecting is a term, as I said, that basically was created around the time the Earth Summit was taking place in Rio. I think the World Resources Institute and a few other U.S. environmental agencies promoted this as an extremely positive way to exploit third world resources. Behind it are a number of assumptions. The first assumption is resources are not used till Western corporations come in to exploit them. To me, that is an abuse of the utilization by women in every household, by peasants, by tribals, by healers, by forest dwellers and indigenous people who are constantly using resource and giving full value to those resources, except that that value is not on the global marketplace, but it is still extremely high value. Bioprospecting is also made to appear as if the resource is unused, unvalued, unknown, and the knowledge is really created from the corporation investment end of things. But bioprospecting is a way of taking knowledge that exists and transferring it, basically, to be then covered through patents and intellectual property in the West. I have called bioprospecting sophisticated biopiracy. The reason it's sophisticated is it doesn't go down and just steal the material and steal the knowledge. It engages the people from whom you will steal to help you in the stealing as if you were going to help them in some way. But, you know, $500 given to a tribe and $5 billion made in profits from the same knowledge, to me is undemocratic, both because over time it incapacitates the original givers from using their knowledge for their own needs and their own societies. Even more, it ends up building for the future a system of centralized control on knowledge and biological diversity, which we need not have, which we cannot afford. Diversity can only be protected as long as we have decentralized economies. If we have centralized control, concentrated monopolies, they will move towards monocultures. They will exploit the diversity but get rid of it. They cannot live in a system of diversity.
We're talking to Dr. Vandana Shiva. She is author of Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, and we'll be back with her in just 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Vandana Shiva. She's the author of Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge. You use the example of Eli Lilly in 1992, which paid, and it's interesting just to see these names, Shaman Pharmaceuticals, a major bioprospecting company, $4 million for exclusive worldwide marketing rights to antifungal drugs drawn from the knowledge of native healers. Dr. Shiva, what does this mean? Does it mean that native healers then can no longer use drugs and market them at a local level?
Well, in the long run, it would mean that. Of course, it'll take 10, 15, 20 years for that exclusion to be built into the way society is run. But if we remember that farmers who used to have absolutely free democratic rights to their seed, to be able to replant their seed, to be able to exchange seeds with their neighbors, are no more able to do it. We know intellectual property rights, which includes patents and breeders' rights in the area of seed, have been used, for instance, to fine a couple called the Winterboers in this country. Asgrow, which is now owned by Monsanto, fined the Winterboers because they were brown bagging seed, which means they were exchanging it with a small group of neighbors. The new contracts that Monsanto is signing with farmers in the United States for Roundup-ready soya are basically contracts that are slavery contracts that basically say you cannot save seed, you cannot use chemicals from any company but us, and we have the right to come and investigate your farm 3 years after you have planted our seed. These are uses of patents and intellectual property rights that have been put to use today in the industrialized world. The dream, of course, of the corporations is that they would be able to do that kind of banning the original donors from utilization over time. Otherwise, they wouldn't be wasting their time with patents. I have hope in people, and I have hope in people's struggle. I personally believe that that dream will not realize. I believe it is the people's dream that will be the shape of democracy in the future, because we can either have a totalitarian control over knowledge and biological diversity, or we can have a democracy of knowledge and a democracy of biodiversity. And I believe that as people come to know more, they will do what Indian farmers have done, what Indian women have done, basically say these are means of theft, they are mechanisms of biopiracy, and we will not allow this to become the basis of the future.
How do you not allow this to become the basis of the future? How do you fight biopiracy, Dr. Vandana Shiva?
I think biopiracy is being fought and will have to be fought by through many ways. One of the most important ways that we have generated over the last 5-6 years, knowing how this concentrated power is coming, is to ensure that people celebrate their knowledge and celebrate their diversity. For example, in agriculture, we are setting up community seed banks across the country where farmers save their seeds, improve their seeds, exchange their seeds freely, and we want to keep these commons alive. We call this the recovery of the biological commons. Just before I left India on this particular trip, an entire village in Kerala had been documenting all its biodiversity, and it had a declaration ceremony to say, this biodiversity is our common resource. It's our common heritage. We have inherited it from our ancestors, and we want to be sure we hand it over to future generations. And we will not allow its privatization. And a young, very young, six-year-old girl then gave this documented knowledge for safekeeping to the village head, who is a woman in this particular case. And it's called the Community Biodiversity Register. What we are working towards is to get Indian laws to recognize these local registers as the equivalent of national patents. To basically say, if people have knowledge and they declare that knowledge to be there, then it has to be treated as an innovation that has been recorded. And therefore, any derived knowledge is basically either it is engaged in through collaboration and partnership, and if it's pirated, it has to be treated as piracy. Of course, we are not stopping at the national level. My dream is that by the year 1999, when the General Agreement of TRIPS and Tariffs intellectual property rights clauses come up for review, and these clauses were drafted, as the Monsanto representative said, with corporations being the patients, the diagnosticians, and the physicians all in one, we want these clauses to be rewritten on the terms of people and on the terms of diversity. And we want TRIPS revised to recognize indigenous innovation, to recognize the need for respecting diverse life forms, and to basically have an honest sharing of knowledge, not an empire emerging out of piracy.
As it stands now, would a community seed bank, would some of the examples that you just gave, would they be GATT illegal?
Well, they could become GATT illegal in a world in which the communities were not aware that they have to set the terms of what is their right. I believe normal life would be GATT illegal if we sleep. You know, if people slumber, living is illegal because trade is the only legitimate reason we live and die. As you might recall, the United States Agriculture Secretary said at the Rome Food Summit, we cannot recognize the right to food because a right to food would stand against the right to free trade. And that's really the crisis we are in, that you can either have freedom for trade, you can have freedom for commerce, or you can have freedom for life. You can have freedom for people to live, and therefore free to have the rights that allow life to happen, which means the right to food, the right to shelter, the right to livelihoods, the right to knowledge, the right to information. These are extremely complex convergences that I believe are happening, and to me, the biodiversity issue is not just a third world issue. I believe the Europeans who are basically saying we would like to see the genetically engineered soybean of Monsanto labeled as genetically engineered are also engaging in that right to freedom, in that right to be able to have food that is free of the hazards of biotechnology. 98% of European consumers insist on labeling. Austria has just had a referendum where 1 million people have voted against genetic engineering in agriculture. These are the democracy movements of our time, and they can only be crushed through brutal totalitarianism worse than anything that the Soviet Union shaped and refined. And I really hope that the world will wake to the fact that what is being shaped in the new totalitarianism around biotechnology, around patents on life, and around total control on resources and markets is worse than any slavery system that the world has ever experienced, because it's enslavement in which the conditions of life itself are at stake.
But Dr. Vandana Shiva, you say you hope to see this by 1999, that indigenous people could get national patents on the products they use and even on themselves. But you're talking about the least empowered people, people with the least amount of power, challenging these corporations that are getting more and more powerful.
Well, first let me correct and clarify you. We've never used the word patent or national patent for what we want to do. We do believe that people's rights should be recognized. We believe these are common rights. Common rights are not private ownership rights. They're not private property rights. And usually patents refer to ownership at the level of private property ownership in ideas and innovation. So basically we are talking about common rights being recognized, and the common rights will be recognized first by people themselves. If a group of villagers, and I'm working with groups of villagers, declare to themselves that we will be patent free and we will not allow our biodiversity to be destroyed or pirated, that community will find the means to ensure that its conditions of life in biodiversity are maintained, rejuvenated, and handed over to future generations. I think the fact that these are the most marginal communities is precisely the reason that they can stand there and say, sorry, we will not participate with your perverse system. Your perverse system of being able to state that you have created life. Your perverse system of being able to state that this life and living diversity is your property. In fact, direct action of that kind usually happens in the most peripheral areas. It'll happen from the margins. And we need to recognize that in this democracy around biodiversity, it will be the indigenous people, the third world peasants, and the women who will lead the world.
Vandana Shiva, a physicist, ecologist, and activist, director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy, based in India. In 1993, she won the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize. I spoke with her just a few days ago when she was in the United States. The name of her book is Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge. You're listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to make a comment on what Vandana Shiva had to say about biotechnology, you can call us on our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. After this short musical break, we're going to come back with one of the top news stories of the week, a major Supreme Court decision, which is quite a blow to third parties in this country. The Supreme Court this week dealt a serious blow to third parties. In a 6-3 ruling on Monday, the court upheld a Minnesota law barring candidates from appearing on more than one party's ballot line. The decision is a setback to the practice known as fusion, in which candidates of big parties are nominated by small ones in order to boost their political clout. And the case was brought by the Twin Cities New Party. Joining us right now is Dan Cantor, the national organizer of the New Party, joining us from Michigan to talk about the significance of this ruling. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dan Cantor.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your response?
Well, it's complicated and also not complicated. At one level, it's an example of how devoted this Supreme Court is to maintaining the two-party system. In the decision, Rehnquist, the Chief Justice, wrote the majority opinion, and he very plainly says states can discriminate against minor parties if they so desire. So at that level, it's a sad day for American democracy when the Supreme Court shows a greater devotion to the two-party system than to democracy itself. On the other hand, I suppose it shouldn't surprise us that one part of the system isn't going to give a tool that would hurt another part. So at some level, we got 3 votes. Would have been better to get 5, and it's a big blow for minor parties, but I don't think it's by any means a death blow.
Can you tell us about the case that went to the Supreme Court, the case that was brought by the Twin Cities Area New Party?
Sure. A very progressive Democratic Party legislator in St. Paul named Andy Dawkins. Our chapter there liked him a lot, nominated him to run on our line because we wanted to send a message to him about support for certain populist economic program. He wanted the nomination, accepted it. The Democratic Party didn't object. And we then tried to put him on the ballot. We were forced to sue our way on all the way up to the Supreme Court. We won at the lower court level, and then we won again in Pennsylvania on another suit. So it was clear that the lower courts, anyway, were beginning to see the argument in our favor, that citizens who support minor political parties should have the same First Amendment rights to nominate the candidates of their choice. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court did not see it that way. So in there are nine states, and your New York listeners are, of course, scratching their heads thinking, what's so unusual about this? New York is the only state in the nation in which fusion is both legal and widely practiced. And so you have the liberal and conservative parties playing a very important role in New York politics. But elsewhere in America, in the other 49 states, it's either illegal or not practiced. There are nine states where it is legal, but nobody ever uses it. So we may have to focus on some of those.
So where does the new party go from here?
Well, there's two things. One is, in terms of the actual electoral work that we do, we continue with it. You know, there's no shortcuts to power. So the running of candidates, we've now run about 200 people for local office and have won 135 of those elections. So we'll continue at that. Try to get that to 400 and 800 and a few thousand over the next couple of years. In terms of fusion, we now have to investigate whether we think we can move on a state-by-state basis, particularly in those states where you could go to a ballot initiative. That's true more in the West than in the East, as you probably know. But we might look at that. We might also look at some city-based proportional voting schemes. We do need to make some changes in the rules of the electoral game for minor parties to flourish. And that's what this lawsuit was about. It was about allowing minor parties a way to project their voice and their values into the public arena. And the Supreme Court said, you know, we're not going to allow that. We are more devoted to the status quo.
You know, I think it's interesting that the Supreme Court acknowledged members of third parties have important First Amendment rights, but said states also have a right to regulate the election process in order to prevent voter confusion and promote political stability. It sounds like, you know, a developing country somewhere talking about promoting political stability.
Yeah, it's, I mean, everybody we have talked to since the decision considers it an appallingly stupid decision. Even a reporter for a paper I won't name, a prominent paper, called it a so-called conclusory opinion. I said, what does that mean? She said it's an opinion with no reasoning, in which they just make up their minds and then try to fill in the gaps later on. So, yeah, their interest in stability, in fact, you know, there's a strong argument that fusion adds to stability, that all the people who are not voting, the 52% that aren't voting, might in fact find a voice in one of these minor parties, and it would attract them back into the electoral process. But they clearly don't care about that. Stability to them means status quo, and that's not the same thing.
A rebuke from the major decision from Justice John Paul Stevens, he wrote, "It demeans the strength of the two-party system to assume that the major parties need to rely on laws that discriminate against independent voters and minor parties." And he was joined in that by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and in part by Justice David Souter.
Yeah,
Souter also filed a separate dissent.
Right. I'm glad you got to see. I thought Stevens's dissent was quite elegant. He basically said all of these reasons Rehnquist is giving are malarkey. Let's talk about the real thing, which is whether or not we should be preserving the two-party system. And he says, that's not our job. The two-party system is not part of the Constitution. And so he was quite, strong and forthright in his dissent. You got to get five.
Dan Kanner, we're going to break this part of the discussion and go to the conversation I had with you and Tammy Johnson of the Progressive Milwaukee New Party at the Labor Notes Convention just about a week ago to talk about where the new party is headed and the kind of issues you're taking on. But for right now, if you could give the number of the new party, your toll-free number.
I'd be happy to. It's 1-800-200-1110. 1294, and I would only say that people, you know, we just have to keep on organizing, and we encourage people to give us a call.
Again, that number, 1-800-200-1294. We've been speaking with Dan Kanner, national organizer of the New Party. He's based in Michigan, and when we come back, we're going to go to Detroit about a week ago at the Labor Notes Conference when I got a chance to speak with him in person with another organizer of the New Party talking about the specific issues that they're taking on. Again, the High Court ruled just Monday that Minnesota law barring candidates from appearing on more than one party's ballot line. Some 40 states, with the notable exception of New York, have such bans. The ruling, a blow to the practice known as fusion, in which candidates of big parties are nominated by small ones in order to boost their political clout. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As I said earlier this month, when I was at the Labor Notes Conference in Detroit, Michigan, which was a gathering of some 1,000 rank-and-file labor activists who say they're there to put democracy back in the labor movement and put movement back into it, I had a chance to sit down with Dan Kanter, who we were just talking to live on the phone, and Tammy Johnson, both of the New Party, Tammy Johnson with Progressive Milwaukee New Party. And I got a chance to talk to them about what the New Party is doing, what are the issues that they're focusing on. This is a part of the conversation we had.
How does the Labor Party fit in with the New Party?
The two groups have different strategies. The New Party is involved in local electoral work now, and the Labor Party has not yet decided what they're going to do on that. But if they do move in the direction of doing electoral work, I would expect that we will work together, because in the end, there's only going to be zero or one new opposition parties in America. There's not going to be two or three or five, and so we do need to get all these things together. I think the reason we're here is labor is the central, or certainly, I think it's fair to say it's probably the central building block to most New Party chapters, or the labor community alliance that Tammy describes. You can't do this work if you're not rooted in the most important organization of working people, namely their unions.
How has the New Party dealt with the AFL-CIO, which is so closely allied with the Democratic Party?
Well, this is the most exciting thing happening in some ways. In February, the AFL-CIO Executive Council invited the New Party to its Executive Council meeting in Los Angeles. First time in 100 years, historians tell us, that the American labor movement has officially invited a minor party to present at the Executive Council level. This was a good step forward. I don't want to overhype it, but it was very exciting to present for an hour and 45 minutes. What's the strategy? What is fusion? What are we working on? Why should the AFL-CIO use this as a way to change their relationship with the Democratic Party? Because they are deeply disgruntled. They see no alternative, or they haven't seen one for many years, but they are deeply unhappy with the Democratic Party. And so what we're saying to them is, here's a way to build a politics that is simultaneously independent and constructive. It's easy to be independent and irrelevant, but to be independent and constructive is difficult.
I'm a little surprised you're saying they're deeply disillusioned with the Democratic Party. I know the rank and file, maybe, but could John Sweeney be any closer to Clinton? The earliest endorsement ever the AFL-CIO gave to him, the $35 million they poured into the elections, this all with, you know, welfare repeal going through and many other issues that Labor is not happy with.
They're organizationally tied to the existing political structures, but you go talk to any local union president or international leader or steward about the coordinated campaigns last fall. That was the supposed Democratic Party labor strategy. They are disgusted with the Democratic Party, but they're not willing to commit suicide. So they find themselves in this unhappy position of always being forced to support them. I don't know what's happening at the very, very top, but there's a lot of willingness to experiment with some new formations. We'll see whether they're willing to take it the next step. One thing that was interesting at the Executive Council meeting was there was a guy in the back of the room pacing around looking very agitated while there's this, you know, fairly lively conversation going on among the political directors of every important union in the country about the need to create a threat of exit vis-a-vis the Democrats, to build a non-business dominated political party. And this guy's looking more and more unhappy, and, you know, we don't know who he is, and we finish. He then follows us to the podium. He's Martin Frost, Democratic congressman from Texas and the head of the so-called DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which is the big soft money laundering operation of the Democrats. And he's up there saying, Victory 98, how to retake the House for the Democrats, having just listened to this nearly two-hour discussion about why what Labor really needs to do is to develop its own independent formation outside of the Democratic Party. So that was sort of... it was an entertaining moment, at least. But the bigger question is, can we persuade Labor to experiment with us, with this kind of idea, a Labor-led, independent political formation with deep ties, deep roots in the community, not just the grassroots. Grassroots are shallow. We want deep roots. Experiment with this in some number of cities. And by which I mean investing some real resources. Labor has substantial financial resources, and we're hoping they'll put millions of dollars into places like Wisconsin and say, go take over Wisconsin and try it in a few places. We don't need to do it everywhere to do it somewhere, just as we don't need to agree on everything to do something together.
What does it mean to vote on the new party line? In other words, what does the new party stand for?
Well, our slogan, you had to get it down to a bumper sticker. We had a contest. We had some interesting entries, but though a fair economy, a real democracy, a new party. The point being you can't have a fair economy without a real democracy, and a real democracy that is not egalitarian is not real. What that means in practice is commitment to such issues as the living wage campaigns, the living wage, the radical notion that people who work for a living ought to get paid enough to support themselves. We're very interested in what we call starting gate equality for children, running social programs through children. You know, most Americans actually think children deserve an equal chance in life. That doesn't mean the outcomes are all the same, but every kid deserves housing and health care and education and nutrition of some minimal standard. And the United States is barbaric in this regard. The level of child poverty in Milwaukee is probably 40% for African-American children. This should make us so ashamed as a people. We're very keen on changing the rules of the electoral game, campaign finance reform, fusion voting, proportional representation, if we can figure out how to win that. So the party might be understood, though, as trying to get off of the left-right axis. Most American politics right now usually runs from, you know, liberals without brains to conservatives without hearts. And most people think, oh, I want to be in the middle of that. We need to rotate that 90 degrees and make it not liberal versus conservative, but top versus bottom. And we want to organize among and represent those people who are for democracy, as opposed to those who are against it, those who are for putting some restraint on corporations, as opposed to those who think the market shall rule. We think this is a huge percentage of the population, you know, the bottom 80%, that is waged workers. And up top is, you know, Michael Eisner and a couple of his lawyers. So we're not, we think there's a gigantic demand, gigantic market, to use the language of the day, for progressive politics. But to reach it, you have to be in actual arenas that most people think of as politics. That means being involved in electoral politics. We're now active in about 10 states. We've run, I guess, about 199 candidates for local and state office and won 133 elections. These are modest-level races, city council, county board, school board, water board, zoning board, and occasionally some state representative races that Tammy can tell you about. But it's the right level, and it's very interesting. There's a big demand we're finding for a sensible progressive politics that reaches people in electoral arenas, but you have to do it. And so that's what's that's our strategy, is to try to do this local first approach, in a sense, a progressive response to the, or progressive answer to the Christian Coalition. Same kind of thing, but with a different set of values undergirding the effort.
We're talking to Danny Cantor, who's the national organizer of the new party here at the Labor Notes Conference. You mentioned Milwaukee, and I'd also like to know what's going on in between elections, how people are preparing. And so we turn to Tammy Johnson, who is the organizer of Progressive Milwaukee, new party. Tell us what that is, how it manifests itself in Milwaukee.
Well, Progressive Milwaukee is the local chapter of new party in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it's really, it started as this coalition of people from various groups, people who worked in the environment and labor and social justice, education, and really what it has come to be in the past 3 to 4 years is this really major political force in the city. We have ran probably 26 elections. We have elected 10 people to office and re-elected some of those people to office. And our major goal is to take over the city, to become the major political force in the city, to run City Hall and to run the county board, so that people not only have a say, but they have control over public policy in the city of Milwaukee.
How did you get involved, Tammy?
Well, I'm the lead organizer, so I'm in charge of making sure that things happen in the chapter, making sure that people attend the rallies and that we continue to be grassroots, that we go door to door. And I got involved basically because I was a student finishing my undergrad career at the university, and I was a political science major. And quite frankly, even though I love politics, I think it's very exciting and it's also very important to our neighborhoods and our community. I couldn't bear the thought of working for the Democratic Party. I felt that it wasn't a party that was representative of my community, which is the African-American community in Milwaukee. And the Republicans was not even a consideration for me. So for people like me, Progressive Milwaukee, the new party, gave a viable alternative, because here was a group that was, first of all, a grassroots political group, people who felt very sincerely and very strong about making sure that they stayed door to door, that they stayed at the street level and organizing block by block. So it wasn't all about going to the state capitol and lobbying with $100,000 lobbyists. It was about getting people out of their houses and into the streets and lobbying on their own behalf. And that was very exciting for me. And the fact that they hired me as a community organizer and not a political consultant was very significant to me. And it's the exact thing that I wanted to do.
So tell me specifically what battles you've waged in Milwaukee and who's won on the new party line.
Well, if you're talking about elections, we have ran people at all local levels of government. We had ran and won people at the city council. We have a city councilman by the name of Don Richards, who was the chief motivator behind a living wage campaign at the city, which we did win.
How did you determine the living wage in Milwaukee?
Well, the standard of living is for a family of four, the poverty level is $770 an hour. And the only reason we call that a living wage is because we demand that there be health care with it. We realize that is still poverty level, and really if you wanted to talk true living wage, you probably should be talking $10 or $12 an hour. But we decided to fight for $770 with health care. So that's how the campaign came about.
And you won.
We won 605 at the city, and it's six since then been indexed up to 641 an hour. And we are in the process of going back to the city to demand the original 770 and the health care.
And so what does that mean? Anyone who does business with the city has to pay that to their workers?
That's exactly right.
And has it meant a significant increase for some people?
Well, what it's meant is two things. One, the city has done very little contracting. In our research, we only found one new contract for janitorial service, and the 120 employees are now getting that floor wage. And there has been no additional contracting. So that's really one of the goals of the Living Wage Campaign, is to encourage governments not to contract out because it's not profitable in that way. But yes, it has at the city meant increases for contracted workers, and especially at the school board where we've won the 770, it not only meant an increase for contracted workers, but for 2,800 direct employees of the school board as well. So it has meant significant wage increase, but also decreased contracting, which is important.
Tammy's modest. To win a raise of, for some people, as much as $2.50 an hour, a 50% raise, how long would it take our union allies, which were core components of this campaign, to win such a raise? They tell us it would take, you know, a decade and a half. How long did it take Progressive Milwaukee, New Party, to win in Milwaukee? It took one meeting. Now, it's not really one meeting. It's 3 years of background work to get the people elected to the board, so that when the time came to raise their hands, you know, the new party candidates are not only voting that way, they're organizing on our behalf.
You've had good success with the Living Wage Campaign in Milwaukee. What else?
Well, if you look at the school board, we've had some impact on school policy in terms of our school is going through tremendous reform. We're a viable voice in the state as far as lobbying for equality in funding. Milwaukee School District is the lowest funded school district in the state because we have a significant central city that does not pay a lot of property tax. And we're probably one of the leading voices at the state level in response to that, in terms of saying that children need to have adequate education, and in order for that to happen, there must be fair funding. We have prevented privatization attempts at the public schools. The for-profit entity, the Edison Project, attempted a little over a year ago to buy out our public school system, and we stopped them cold. We went to every hearing and every meeting that they attended and really put them out on Front Street as far as who they really were, and that they didn't really care about the black children and the Latino children and the poor white children of Milwaukee. They care about making profits, and they were stopped.
Who are they? And you're saying that they wanted to educate the kids and also make a profit?
The Edison Project was an entity that was founded by Chris Whittle, and it was a for-profit scheme put together to shop around to various public schools throughout the country to attempt to privatize either all or part of public education. They wanted to run schools, and they wanted the state to give tax money to them to run these schools. And so there was an attempt on our public education system in Milwaukee to do that, and we stopped the attempt. We really showed that they were at that point $50 million in debt, and they needed Milwaukee schools in order to get out of that debt. And they weren't caring about the education of our children. They were caring about the $7,000 per pupil that they would get, and the ability to advertise all kinds of products in this classroom and sell that advertisement. That's what they cared about. And we really showed that for what it was, and they eventually figured out that they weren't going to win this, that the public support wasn't there, because the public support behind us, behind really educating and supporting public education and not private. So that was a tremendous victory that we had about 2 years ago in public education. And right now we're in the process of battling the voucher system that's rampant in Wisconsin and is beginning to start in other states. And we're trying to really say that, look, public education education is necessary. It's important. The overwhelming majority of our children are going to be in public schools. So instead of putting our tax monies elsewhere to private schools where we have no control, no regulations, there are no unions there, and there are low salaries, and there's no checks on what they're truly educating our children, let's invest in public education.
Tammy Johnson and Dan Kanner, both with the New Party. And again, the 800 number of the New Party is 1-800-200-1294. That's 1-800-200-1294. I was speaking with them at the Labor Notes Conference in Detroit last week. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call our toll-free number at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, assistant producer Errol Maitland. Errol Maitland, our engineer, as well as Kenneth Mason, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Tomorrow on May Day, we speak with Studs Terkel and also Michael Lapsley, priest and partisan, A South African Journey. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.